wash of desert air when one walked the gangway down onto Muslim soil. Yemen, the UAE. He had flown over the Alps at sunset, had battled thunderstorms over the Balkans. In James's mind, he was a satellite, graceful and self-sufficient, orbiting the Earth, fulfilling its designated purpose without question.
"We were supposed to have Gaston on the other stick," said James.
"You know Peter?"
"Yes, he's lovely."
"Too bad."
She smiled, showing teeth, and it was enough. To make a beautiful woman smile, to feel the warmth of her attention. He went into the cockpit and ran through the systems again, checking maintenance's work.
10 minutes, he called out.
As he rechecked the systems, he felt the plane shift.
"That will be my co-pilot coming back," he thought.
According to the roster, his wingman today was Peter Gaston, an idiosyncratic Belgian who liked to talk philosophy on long flights. James always enjoyed their conversations, especially when they delved into areas between science and ideology. He waited for him to enter the cockpit, but instead James heard whispering from the main cabin, and then something that sounded like a slap. He stood at the sound, frowning, and was almost to the cockpit door when a different man came in, holding his left cheek.
"Sorry," he said. "I got held up in the office."
Melody recognized him, a glassy-eyed kid, perhaps in his 20s, his tie askew. Charlie something. He'd flown with him once before, and though technically the kid performed well, James frowned.
"What happened to Gaston?" he said.
"You got me," said Charlie. "Stomach thing, I think. All I know is I got a call."
James was annoyed, but he wasn't about to show it, so he shrugged. It was the front office's problem.
"Well, you're late. I called maintenance about some stickiness in the yoke."
The kid shrugged, rubbed his cheek. James could see Emma behind him. She'd retreated into the main cabin and was smoothing the linens on the headrests.
"Everything okay out here?"
James asked, more to her than the kid. She smiled at him in a far-off way, keeping her eyes down. He looked at Charlie.
"All good, Captain," said Charlie. "Just singing a song I shouldn't have been singing."
"Well, I don't know what that means, but I don't tolerate funny business on my bird. Do I need to call the front office, get another man?"
"No, sir. No funny business. Just here to get the job done. Nothing else."
James studied him. The kid held his eyes. A rogue of sorts, he decided. Not dangerous, just used to getting his way. He was handsome in a crooked sort of fashion, with a Texas twang. Loose. That's how James would describe him. Not a planner. More of a go-with-the-flow sort. And James was okay with that in principle. He could be flexible when it came to staff, as long as they did what they were told. The kid needed discipline was all, and James would give it to him.
"Okay, then, take your seat and get on with control. I want to be wheels up in 5. You've got a schedule to keep."
"Yes, sir,"
said Charlie with an unreadable grin, and got to work. And then the first passengers came aboard. The client and his family, plane shifting as they climbed the gangway, and James made himself available for conversation. He always liked to meet the souls he flew, to shake hands and put faces to names. It made the work more meaningful, especially when there were children. He was captain of this ship, after all, responsible for all lives. It didn't feel like servitude. It felt like a privilege. Only in the modern world did people believe that they should be the ones receiving. But James was a giver. He didn't know what to do when people tried to pamper him. If he caught a seat on a commercial flight, he always found himself getting up to help the flight attendants stow baggage or grabbing blankets for pregnant passengers. Someone had once said to him, "It's hard to be sad when you're being useful." And he liked that idea, that service to others brought happiness. It was self-involvement that led to depression, to spiraling questions about the meaning of things. This had always been his mother's problem. She thought too much of herself and not enough of others. James had built himself to be the opposite. Often he considered what his mother would do in any situation, what the wrong decision was, and it clarified for him what he should do instead. In this way, he used her as the North Star on a journey where you always want to go south. It was helpful,
aligning himself in this way. It gave him something to tune to, like a violin to a piano. They were in the air 5 minutes later, taking off to the west and banking toward the coast. The yoke still felt a little sticky when he moved it starboard, but he put it down to an idiosyncrasy of the plane. The Blacks. The first night, Scott sleeps on a pull-out sofa in the sewing room. He hadn't planned on staying, but in the aftermath of the day's news, he felt Eleanor might need the support, especially since her husband seemed to have disappeared.
"He turns off his phone when he's working," said Eleanor, though the way she said it seemed to indicate that the word working really meant drinking.
Now, on the verge of a dream, Scott hears Doug come home around 1, the sound of tires on the driveway waking him with a jolt of adrenaline. There is that animal surge of primitive nerves, eyes opening in an unfamiliar room, unsure for a long moment of where he is. A sewing table sits under the window, the machine a strange, looming predator in the shadows. Downstairs, the front door closes. Scott hears feet on the stairs. He listens as they approach, then stop outside his door. Silence again, like a breath held. Scott lies coiled, tense, an unwanted guest in another man's house. Outside, he becomes aware of Doug breathing, a bearded man in overalls drunk on artisanal bourbon and microbrews. Outside the window, the cicadas are cutting a bloody racket in the yard. Scott thinks of the ocean, filled with invisible predators. You hold your breath and dive into the closing darkness, like sliding down a giant's throat, no longer even human in your mind. Pray. A floorboard pops in the hall as Doug shifts his weight. Scott sits up and stares at the doorknob, a dim copper ball in the darkness. What will he do if it turns? If Doug enters drunk, ready for a fight? Breathe. Again. Somewhere the air conditioner's compressor kicks on, and the low duct thrust of forced air breaks the spell. The house is just a house again. Scott listens as Doug walks down the hall to the bedroom. He exhales slowly, realizing he's been holding his breath. In the morning, he takes the boy out looking for rocks to skip. They scour the grounds of the riverbank looking for flat, smooth stones. Scott, in his city shoes, and the boy in little pants and a little shirt, each shoe smaller than Scott's hand. He shows the boy how to stand, cockeyed to the water, and sidearm projectiles across the surface. For a long time, the boy can't do it. He furrows his brow and tries over and over, clearly frustrated, but refusing to give up. He chews his tongue inside his closed mouth and makes a working sound, half song, half drone, selecting his stones carefully. The first time he gets a two-hopper, he jumps in the air and claps his hands. "Nice, buddy," Scott tells him. Energized, the boy runs off to collect more stones. They are on a thin strip of brambly bank on the edge of the woods at a wide bend in the Hudson. The morning sun is behind them, blockaded by trees on the rise, its first rays cresting the far shore. Scott sits on his heels and puts his hand in the moving water. It is cool and clear, and for a moment he wonders if he will ever go swimming again, ever fly on another plane. He can smell silt in the air, and somewhere a tinge of cut grass. He is aware of his body as a body, muscles engaged, blood flowing. Around him, unseen birds call to each other without urgency, just a steady interchange of heckle and whoop. The boy throws another stone, laughing. Is this how healing starts? Last night, Eleanor came into the living room to tell him he had a call. Scott was on his knees playing trucks with the boy. Who would be calling me here?
She said her name was Layla, Eleanor said.
Scott got to his feet, went into the kitchen. How did you know I was here? He asked.
Sweetie, she said, what else is money for?
Her voice dropped, moving to a more intimate octave.
Tell me you're coming back soon, she said. I'm spending like all my time on the third floor sitting inside your painting. It's so good. Did I tell you I've been to that farmer's market? When I was a kid. My dad had a place on the vineyard. I grew up eating ice cream in that courtyard. It's eerie. The first time I ever handled cash was to go buy peaches from Mr. Cozzelli. I was 6.
I'm with the boy now, Scott told her. He needs me, I think. I don't know. Kids, psychology. Maybe I'm just in the way.
Through the phone, Scott heard Layla take a sip of something. Well, she said, I've got buyers lined up for every painting you make in the next 10 years. I'm talking to the Tate later about mounting a solo show this winter. Your rep sent me the slides. They're breathtaking. These words, once so coveted, were Chinese to him now.
I have to go, he told her.
Hold on, she said, purring. Don't just run. I miss you.
What's going on? He asked. In your mind, with us.
Let's go to Greece, she told him. There's a little house on a cliff I own through, like, 6 shell companies. Nobody knows a thing. Complete mystery. We could lie in the sun and eat oysters, dance after dark, wait till the dust clears. I know I should be coy with you, but I've never met anyone whose attention is harder to get. Even when we're together, it's like we're in the same place, but different years.
After he hung up, Scott found JJ had moved to the desk in the living room. He was using Eleanor's computer, playing an educational game, moving letter tiles. Hey, buddy.
The boy didn't look up. Scott pulled up a chair and sat down next to him. He watched the boy drag the letter B onto a matching square. Above it, a cartoon bug sat on a leaf. The boy dragged the U, then the G.
Do you mind if I... said Scott.
Could I?
He reached for the mouse, moved the cursor. He didn't own a computer himself, but he had spent enough time watching people on laptops in coffee shops to understand what to do, he thought.
How do I... he asked after a moment, more to himself than the boy. Search for something.
The boy took the mouse. Concentrating, chewing his tongue, he opened a browser window, went to Google, then gave the mouse back to Scott.
Great, said Scott.
Thanks.
He typed D-W-O, then stopped, not knowing the spelling.
He erased the word, then typed Red Sox, video, longest at bat, hit enter. The page loaded. Scott clicked on a video link. The boy showed him how to maximize the window. He felt like a caveman staring into the sun.
You can... it's okay to watch, I think, he told the boy, then hit play.
On screen, the video began. The quality was pixelated, the colors saturated, as if, rather than record the game the normal way, the poster had filmed their own television screen. Scott imagined that. A man sitting in his living room, filming a baseball game on TV, creating a game within a game, the image of an image.
Dworkin struck out and singled to center field, the announcer said.
Behind him, the roar of the crowd was loud, filtered through TV speakers and compressed further by the viewer's camera. The batter stepped into the box. He was a tall Hoosier with a Mennonite beard, no mustache. He took a few practice swings. In the control room, they cut to the pitcher, Wakefield, bobbling the rosin. Behind him, towers of floodlights flared the corners of the screen. A night game in summer, 86 degrees with winds out of the southwest. From Gus, Scott knew that Dworkin's at-bat started as the wheels of their plane left the tarmac. He thought about that now. The speed of the plane, the flight attendant in her jump seat, and how much more quickly the private jet left the ground than a commercial flight did. He watched Dworkin take a pitch low and outside. Ball one. The camera moved to the crowd. Men in sweatshirts, kids with hats and gloves, waving at the lens. The pitcher wound up. Dworkin readied himself, bat hovering above his right shoulder. The ball was released. Scott clicked the mouse, pausing the image.
The pitcher froze, back leg raised, left arm extended. 60 feet away, Dworkin readied himself. From the news, Scott knew that 22 more pitches were coming. 22 pitches thrown over a span of 18 minutes, pitch after pitch, fouled into the stands or back into the net. The slow drawl of baseball time, a game of lazy Sundays and dugout chatter. Wind up and pitch. But right now the game was paused, frozen, the ball floating in midair. 22 pitches. The game already nearly 3 weeks old, but for a first-time viewer, it was as if the events on screen were happening for the first time. As if the whole earth had rewound. Who knew what would happen next? Dworkin could strike out, or homer into deep left field, high above the green monster. Sitting there with the boy, Scott couldn't help but think, what if everything else reset with the game? If the whole world cycled back to 10 p.m. on the night of August 23, 2015, then stopped. He imagined the cities of the planet frozen, red light traffic pressed in perfect unison. He pictured smoke hovering motionless above suburban chimneys, cheetahs caught in mid-stride on the open plains. On screen, the ball was just a white dot trapped between a point of departure and its destination. If it was true, if somehow the world had wound itself back, then somewhere he was on an airplane. They were all on an airplane. A family of four, the banker and his wife, a beautiful flight attendant, children. They were alive, paused, the girl listening to music, the men jawing, watching the game, Maggie in her seat, smiling into the face of her sleeping son. As long as he didn't restart the game, they would live. As long as he never clicked the mouse. The ball in midair was the plane in midair, its destiny unmet. He stared at it, and was surprised to find his eyes watering, the pixels on screen blurring, the man at the plate just a smudge, the ball a random snowflake out of season. At the river, Scott lowers his hand into the water, lets the current pull at his wrist. He remembers looking out the window this morning and watching Doug pack his pickup truck with bags. He was yelling words that Scott couldn't make out, and then he slammed the cab door and pulled out of the driveway, spraying gravel. What happened? Is he gone for good? A noise rises on the periphery. It starts as an industrial hum. A distant chainsaw, maybe. Trucks on the interstate. Except there is no interstate nearby. And Scott pays it no attention as he watches the boy dig into the muddy shore and pull out coins of shale and quartz. He begins at a far point and works his way back, searching the mud first with his eyes, then his fingers. The chainsaw gets louder, taking on a low bass rumble. Something is coming. Scott stands, becoming aware of wind, the westward lean of trees, leaves shimmering, mimicking the sound of applause. In the distance, the boy stops what he's doing and looks up. In that moment, a Jurassic roar overtakes them as the helicopter comes in low over the trees behind them. Scott ducks his head reflexively. The boy starts to run. The helicopter swoops through bright sun like a bird of prey, then slows as it reaches the far bank and begins to circle back. It is black and shiny, like a pincered beetle. JJ approaches at a full run, a look of fear on his face. Scott picks him up without thinking and moves into the trees. He runs in his city shoes through low brush, snaking between poplars and elms, poison ivy brushing his cuffs. Once again, he is a muscle of survival, an engine of rescue. The boy's arms are wrapped around his neck, legs around his waist. He faces backward, his eyes wide, chin on Scott's shoulder. His knees dig into Scott's sides. When they get back to the house, Scott sees the helicopter settle in the backyard. Eleanor has come out onto the front porch and has a hand on her head, trying to keep her hair from blowing into her face. The pilot shuts off the engine, rotors slowing. Scott hands the boy to Eleanor. "What's going on?" she says. You should take him inside, Scott tells her, then turns to see Gus Franklin and Agent O'Brien climb out of the Whirlybird. They approach, O'Brien ducked low, hand on his head, Gus walking upright, confident that he is shorter than the blades. The engine whirl slows and quiets. Gus sticks out his hand.
Sorry for the drama, he says, but given all the leaks, I thought we should reach you before the news got out.
Scott shakes his hand.
You remember Agent O'Brien? Says Gus.
O'Brien spits into the grass.
Yeah, he says. He remembers.
Wasn't he off the case? Says Scott. Gus squints into the sun.
Let's just say some new facts are moving the FBI to the front of the investigation.
Scott looks puzzled. O'Brien pats his arm.
Let's go inside.
They sit in the kitchen. Eleanor puts on an episode of Cat in the Hat to distract the boy. Too much TV, she thinks. I'm giving him too much airtime. Then sits on the edge of her seat, jumping up every time he stirs.
Okay, says O'Brien. This is me taking off the gloves.
Scott looks at Gus, who shrugs. There's nothing he can do. The divers recovered the cockpit door this morning, lasering the hinges and floating it to the surface. Tests showed the holes were indeed bullet holes. This triggered a shift in procedural authority. Phone calls were made from government offices, and Gus was told in no uncertain terms that he should give the FBI as much operational leeway as they required. Oh, and by the way, he was getting O'Brien back. Apparently the brass was convinced that O'Brien wasn't their leak. Plus, it turned out, he was being groomed for big things, Gus's liaison explained. So they were putting him back on the case. 10 minutes later, O'Brien walked into the hangar with a team of 12 men and asked for a sit rep. Gus saw no point in fighting. He was a pragmatist by nature, as much as he disliked the man personally. He told O'Brien that they'd recovered all remaining bodies except for Gil Baruch, the Bateman's body man. It looked as if he had either been thrown clear of the others or had floated out of the fuselage in the days after the crash. If they were lucky, his body would wash up somewhere, as Emma's and Sarah's had, or quite possibly it was simply gone. The questions, as Gus saw them, were as follows. 1. Who fired the shots? The obvious suspect was the security man, Gil Baruch, the only passenger known to be armed. But since none of the passengers or crew had gone through a security screening before boarding the plane, they were all potential shooters. 2. Why had the shots been fired? Was the shooter attempting to force his way into the cockpit in order to hijack the plane, or simply to crash it? Or was the shooter attempting to get inside the cockpit to avert the crash? Villain or a hero? That was the question. 3. Why was the captain in the main cabin and not the cockpit? If it was a possible hijack scenario, was he a hostage? Had he come out to defuse the situation? But if that was the case, 4. Why was there no mayday from the co-pilot? Speaking of the co-pilot, divers had found Charles Bush strapped into his seat in the cockpit, hands still gripping the yoke. One of the bullets had buried itself in the floor behind him, but there was no evidence that anyone had made it inside the cockpit before the plane hit the water. Gus told the agent that autopsy results on Bush would be back that afternoon. None of them knew what they were hoping for. The best-case scenario, in Gus's mind, was that the young man had suffered a stroke or heart attack. The worst case, well, the worst case was this was a calculated act of mass murder. All loose debris had been tagged and bagged and was here now, being cataloged. The good news was that the black box and data recorders had been recovered. The bad news was that it appeared one or both may have been damaged in the crash. Techs would work around the clock to recover every last trace of data. By the end of the day, Gus told him, barring an unexpected turn of weather, the fuselage should be up and on its way to the hangar. O'Brien listened to everything Gus said, then called in the helicopter. Now, in the kitchen, Agent O'Brien makes a show of taking a small notebook out of his pocket. He removes a pen, unscrews the cap, lays it next to the pad. Gus can feel Scott's eyes on him, questioning, but he keeps his focus on O'Brien as if to signal to Scott, "This is where you should be looking now." They have agreed not to discuss the case on the phone, not to put anything in writing until they find out how O'Brien's memo was leaked. From now on, all conversations will take place in person. It is the paradox of modern technology. The tools we use can be used against us. "As you know," says O'Brien, "we found the plane. And Mrs. Dunleavy, I'm afraid I have to tell you that yes, we have officially recovered the bodies of your sister, her husband, and your niece." Eleanor nods. She feels like a bone that has been left to bleach in the sun. She thinks about the boy in the living room watching TV. Her boy. And what she will say to him, or should say to him. She thinks about Doug's last words this morning. "This isn't over." "Mr. Burroughs," says O'Brien, turning to Scott, "you need to tell me everything you remember about the flight." "Why?" "Because I told you to." "Scott," says Gus. "No," O'Brien snaps. "We're done holding this guy's hand." He turns to Scott. "Why was the pilot outside the cockpit during the flight?" Scott shakes his head. "I don't remember that." "You said you heard banging before the plane crashed. We asked if you thought it was mechanical. You said you didn't think so. What do you think it was?" Scott looks at him, thinking. "I don't know. The plane pitched. I hit my head. They're not memories, really." O'Brien studies him. "There are 6 bullet holes in the cockpit door."
"What?"
says Eleanor, her face draining of blood. The words push Scott back in his chair. "Bullet holes? What are they saying?" "Did you ever see a gun?" O'Brien asks Scott. "No." "Do you remember the Bateman's body man, Gil Baruch?" "The big guy by the door. Scott loses his words, mind racing. "You never saw him pull a gun?" O'Brien asks. Scott racks his brain. Somebody shot up the cockpit door. He tries to make sense of that. The plane pitched. People screamed, and somebody shot up the door. The plane was going down. The captain was outside the cockpit. Somebody shot up the door trying to get in. Or was the gun pulled first, and the co-pilot, put the plane into a dive to, what, throw him off balance? Either way, they're saying this wasn't mechanical error or human error. It was something worse. There is a visceral twist of nausea in Scott's guts, as if it's only hitting him now how close he came to death. And then a wave of lightheadedness as the next thought strikes him. If this wasn't an accident, then it means someone tried to kill him. That instead of an act of fate, he and the boy were victims of an attack. "I got on the plane," he says, "and took a seat. She brought me some wine. Emma. I said, no thank you. Asked for some water. Sarah, the banker's wife, was talking in my ear about taking her daughter to the Whitney Biennial. The game was on TV, baseball. And the men, David and the banker, they were watching, cheering. My bag was in my lap. She wanted to take it, the flight attendant, but I held on to it, and as we taxied, I started going through it. I don't know why, something to do. Nerves." "What made you nervous?" asks O'Brien. Scott thinks about it. "It was a big trip for me. And the plane, having to run for the plane, I was discombobulated a little. It all seems meaningless now, how much it mattered. Meetings with art reps, gallery visits. I had all the slides in my bag, and after the run, I wanted to make sure I still had them. For no reason." He looks at his hands. "I was in the window seat looking out at the wing, Everything was foggy, and then suddenly the fog cleared. Or we rose above it, I guess, is what happened. And it was just night. And I looked over at Maggie, and she smiled. Rachel was in the seat behind her, listening to music, and the boy was asleep with a blanket over him. And I don't know why, but I thought she might like a drawing, Maggie. So I took out my pad and started sketching the girl. 9 years old, headphones on, looking out the window. He remembers the look on the girl's face, a child lost in thought. But something in her eyes, a sadness, hinting at the woman she would one day become, and how she had come to the barn that day with her mother to look at Scott's work, a growing girl, all legs and hair. "We hit a couple of bumps going up," he says, enough to shake the glasses, but it was pretty smooth otherwise, and nobody seemed worried. The security man sat in the front with a flight attendant for takeoff on the, what do you, jump seat? But he was up as soon as the seatbelt sign was off. "Doing?" "Nothing. Standing." "No drama." "No drama. And you were drawing?" "Yes." "And then?" Scott shakes his head. He remembers chasing his pencil across the floor, but not what happened before. The lie of an airplane is that the floor is always level. The straight angles of the plane, tricking your mind into thinking you're sitting or standing at a 90-degree angle to the world, even when the plane is on its side. But then you look out the window and find yourself staring at the ground. The plane banked. The pencil fell. He unbuckled his seatbelt to chase it, and it rolled across the floor like a ball going downhill. And then he was sliding, and his head hit something. Scott looks at Gus. "I don't know." Gus looks at O'Brien.
"I have a question," Gus says. "Not about the crash. About your work."
"Okay.
Who's the woman?"
Scott looks at him. "The woman?"
"In all the paintings. I noticed. There's always a woman, and it's always, from what I can see, the same woman. Who is she?"
Scott exhales. He looks at Eleanor. She is watching him. What must she think? Days ago, her life was a straight line. Now all she has are burdens.
"I had a sister," says Scott. "She drowned when she was 16. Night swimming in Lake Michigan with some kids. Just dumb kids. I'm sorry."
"Yeah." Scott wishes there was something profound he could say about it. But there isn't. Later, after the boy is asleep, Scott calls Gus from the kitchen.
"Was that okay today?" he asks.
"It was helpful, thank you."
"Helpful how?" Scott wants to know.
"Details. Who sat where? What people were doing?"
Scott sits at the table. There was a moment, after the helicopter departed and Eleanor and Scott were left alone, when both of them seemed to realize that they were strangers, that the illusion of the last 24 hours, the idea that the house was a bubble they could hide in, had dissolved. She was a married woman, and he was, what, the man who rescued her nephew. What did they really know about each other? How long was he staying? Did she even want him to? Did he? An awkwardness arose between them then, and when Eleanor started cooking, Scott told her he wasn't hungry. He needed a walk to clear his head. He stayed out until after dark, wandering back to the river and watching the water turn from blue to black as the sun set and the moon came out. He was farther than he'd ever been from the man he thought he was.
"Well," Gus tells him over the phone, "nobody knows this yet, but the flight recorder's damaged. Not destroyed, but it's going to take work to get to the data. I've got a team of 6 guys in there working now, and the governors of 2 states are calling every 5 minutes for updates."
"I can't help you with that. I can barely open a tube of paint."
"No, I'm telling you because you deserve to know. Everybody else can go to hell."
"I'll tell Eleanor."
"How's the boy?"
He's not talking, really, but he seems to like that I'm here, so maybe that's therapeutic. Eleanor's really strong.
And the husband?
He left this morning with luggage. A long pause.
I don't have to tell you how that's going to look, says Gus.
Scott nods. Since when does how a thing looks matter more than what it is? He asks.
2012, I think, says Gus. Especially after your hideout in the city. How that made the news. The heiress, which I said find some place to hide, not shack up in a tabloid story.
Scott rubs his eyes. Nothing happened.
I mean, yeah, she took off her clothes and climbed into bed with me, but I didn't. We're not talking about what did or didn't happen, says Gus. We're talking about what it looks like.
In the morning, Scott hears Eleanor down in the kitchen. He finds her at the stove making breakfast. The boys on the floor, playing between rooms. Wordlessly, Scott sits on the floor next to him and picks up a cement truck. They play for a moment, rolling rubber wheels on the wooden floors. Then the boy offers Scott a gummy bear from a bag, and he takes it. Outside, the world continues to spin. Inside, they go through the motions of daily life, pretending that everything is normal. Emma Leitner, July 11, 1990, to August 23, 2015. It was about setting boundaries and sticking to them. You smiled at the client, served them drinks. You laughed at their jokes and made small talk. You flirted. You were a fantasy to them, just like the plane. The beautiful girl with the million-dollar smile, making men feel like kings as they sat on a luxury jet talking on three cell phones at once. Under no circumstances did you give out your phone number. You certainly did not kiss an internet millionaire in the galley or have sex with a basketball star in a private bedroom. And you never went with a billionaire to a second location, even if that second location was a castle in Monaco. You were a flight attendant, a service professional, not a prostitute. You had to have rules, boundaries, because in the land of the rich, it was easy to lose your way. At 25, Emma Leitner had traveled to all seven continents. Working for Gullwing, she had met movie stars and sheikhs. She had flown with Mick Jagger and Kobe Bryant. One night after a cross-country flight, LAX to JFK, Kanye West chased her onto the tarmac and tried to give her a diamond bracelet. She didn't take it, of course. Emma had long since stopped being flattered by the attention. Men old enough to be her grandfather routinely suggested she could have anything she wanted if she joined them for dinner in Nice or Gstaad or Rome. It was the altitude, she sometimes thought, the possibility of death by falling. But what it really was the arrogance of money, and the need of the wealthy to possess everything they saw. The truth was, Emma was nothing more to her clients than a Bentley or a condo or a pack of gum. To female passengers, wives of clients or clients themselves, Emma was both a threat and a cautionary tale. She represented the old paradigm, where beautiful women in conical bras catered to the secret needs of powerful men in smoky clubs, a geisha, a playboy bunny. She was a stealer of husbands, or worse, a reflection in the mirror, a reconstruction of their own paths to moneyed wifery, a reminder. Emma felt their eyes on her as she moved through the cabin. She endured the steely-tongued jabs of women in oversized sunglasses who sent back their drinks and told her to be more careful next time. She could fold a napkin into the shape of a swan and mix a perfect gimlet. She knew which wines to pair with oxtail stew or venison paella, could perform CPR, and had been trained to do an emergency tracheotomy. She had skills, not just looks. But that never mattered to these women. On the bigger jets, there would be 3 to 5 girls working. On the smaller plane, it was just Emma, in a short blue skirt suit, handing out drinks and demonstrating the safety features of the Cessna Citation Bravo, or Hawker 900 XP. The exits are here. The seatbelts work just so, oxygen masks. Your seat may be used as a flotation device. She lived her life in turnaround time, the hours and days spent between flights. The travel company kept apartments in most major international cities. It was cheaper than buying hotel rooms for the crew. Anonymously modern with parquet floors and Swedish cabinetry, each apartment was designed to resemble the other, the same furniture, the same fixtures. In the words of the company handbook, in order to lessen the effects of jet lag. But to Emma, the uniformity of the space had the opposite effect, increasing her feeling of displacement. It was easy to wake in the middle of the night and not know which city you were in, which country. Occupancy of any company safe house usually hovered around 10 people. This meant that at any one time, there might be a German pilot and 6 South Africans sleeping 2 to a room. They were like modeling agency apartments filled with beautiful girls, except in one room, there'd be a couple of 46-year-old pilots farting in their sleep. Emma had been 21 when she started, the daughter of an Air Force pilot and a stay-at-home mom. She had studied finance in college, but after 6 months working for a big New York investment bank, had decided she wanted to travel instead. The luxury economy was exploding, and jet companies and yacht companies and private resorts were desperate for attractive, competent, bilingually discreet people who could start right away. The truth was, she loved planes. One of her first and best memories was of riding in the cockpit of a Cessna with her dad. Emma couldn't have been more than 5 or 6. She remembers the clouds through the tiny oval windows, towering white shapes her mind transformed into puppies and bears. So much so that when they got home, Emma told her mother that her dad had taken her to see the zoo in the sky. She remembers her father from that day, seen from a low angle, strong-jawed and immortal, his close-cropped hair and aviator sunglasses. Michael Aaron Leitner, 26 years old, a fighter jet pilot with arms like knotted ropes. No one in her life would ever be a man the way her father was a man, sharp-toothed and steely-eyed, with a dry Midwestern wit. A man of few words who could cut a cord of firewood in 10 minutes and never wore a seatbelt. She had seen him once knock a man out with a single punch, a lightning strike that was over before it began, the knockout a foregone conclusion, her father already walking away as the other man crumpled to the ground. This was at a gas station outside San Diego. Later, Emma would learn that the man had said something lewd to her mother as she went to the restroom. Her father, pumping gas, saw the exchange and approached the man. Words were had. Emma doesn't remember her father raising his voice. There was no heated argument, no macho chest bump or warning shove. Her father said something. The man said something back. And then the punch, a whip crack to the jaw that started at the hip, and then her father was walking back to the car, the man tipping backward and toppling, like a tree. Her dad lifted the nozzle from the gas tank and set it back on its arm, screwing the gas cap in place. Emma, her face pressed to the window, watched her mother return from the restroom, saw her glance at the unconscious stranger and slow, her face confused. Her father called to her and then held the door for his wife before climbing into the driver's seat. Emma knelt in the back seat and stared out the back window, waiting for the police. Her father was something else now, not just a dad. He was her knight, her protector. And when they taxied down private runways, Emma would close her eyes and picture that moment, the words exchanged, the man falling. She would fly high into the troposphere, into the dark recesses of space, slipping weightless inside a single perfect memory. Then the captain would turn off the fastened seatbelt sign, and Emma would snap back to reality. She was a 25-year-old woman with a job to do. So she'd stand and smooth the wrinkles of her skirt, already smiling her collusive yet professional smile, ready to play her part in the ongoing seduction of wealth. It wasn't hard. There was a checklist you went through as you prepared for takeoff, and another one as you started your final descent. Jackets were distributed, cocktails refreshed. Sometimes, if the flight was short and the meal comprised more than four courses, the plane would sit on the runway for an hour while dessert and coffee were served. When it came to high-end private travel, the journey was the destination. And then, after your guests had disembarked, there were dishes to be cleared and stowed. But the real dirty work was left for the locals, Emma and the others descending the gangway and sliding into their own sleek transport. Emma Leitner lived her life in turnaround time, but it was the turnaround she found the most depressing. It wasn't just the luxury of her work surroundings that made it difficult to return to a normal life. It wasn't just the town car that took you to and from work, or the Swiss watch precision and opulence of the plane. It wasn't simply that you spent your days and nights surrounded by millionaires and billionaires, men and women who, even as they reminded you that you were their servant, also, if you were beautiful like Emma, made you feel like part of the club. Because in today's economy, beauty is the great equalizer. A backstage pass. For Emma, what made it so hard to return to the tiny apartment in the West Village she shared with two other girls was the sudden realization that for all those weeks of traveling, she had been a stowaway in someone else's life, an actor on a stage playing a part. She was the royal escort, the chaste concubine, immersed in servitude for weeks at a time until the rules and boundaries she set to navigate her professional life became the backbone of her personal life as well. She found herself growing increasingly lonely, an object to be looked at, but never touched. On Friday, August 21st, she flew from Frankfurt to London on a Learjet 60XR. It was her and Chelsea Norquist, a gap-toothed blonde from Finland, in the main cabin. The clients were German oil company executives, meticulously dressed and unfailingly polite. They landed at 6 p.m. GMT at Farnborough Airport, bypassing all the drag and bureaucracy of Heathrow or Gatwick. The executives, overcoated with mobile phones glued to their ears, descended the external stairway to a limousine waiting on the tarmac. Parked behind the limo was a black SUV waiting to take the flight crew into the city. Here in London, the company apartment was in South Kensington, a short walk from Hyde Park. Emma had stayed there at least a dozen times. She knew which bed she wanted, which nearby bars and restaurants she could escape to, the ones where she could order a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, open a book, and recharge. The pilot on the Frankfurt flight, Stanford Smith, was a former British Air Force lieutenant in his early 50s. The first officer, Peter Gaston, was a 36-year-old chain smoker from Belgium who hit on all the girls with a tenacity and good humor that ironically made him seem toothless. He had a reputation among gullwing crews as the guy to see if you needed ecstasy or coke, the man to call in a pinch if you last minute had to find clean piss for a company drug screen. Traffic on the A4 was bumper to bumper. Sitting next to Emma in the middle row of the Cadillac, Chelsea worked her iPhone, setting and revising the social agenda for the night. She was 27, a party girl with a weakness for musicians.
"No, you stop it," she said, giggling.
"I'm telling you," Stanford announced from the back row, "you roll a pair of pants. You don't fold them." "Merde," said Peter. "You want flat surfaces for stacking." Like all people who travel for a living, Stanford and Peter believed they were experts at the art of packing. The subject was a constant source of disagreement among crews all over the world. Sometimes the differences were cultural. Germans believed that shoes had to be stored in sleeves. The Dutch were strangely fond of garment bags. Veterans tested rookies randomly, usually after a few drinks, grilling them on the proper strategy in packing for an SAT of possible trips, a midwinter overnighter from Bermuda to Moscow, a two-day layover in Hong Kong in August. What size and brand of suitcase? A single heavy coat or layers? The order in which items went into a suitcase was critical. Emma had little interest in the subject. She felt what she put inside her suitcase was a private matter. To derail the subject, she would smile demurely and announce that she slept naked and never wore panties, which was a lie. The girl wore flannel pajamas to bed, which she rolled separately and vacuum-sealed in reusable plastic bags when traveling. But the ploy usually worked in changing the subject from packing to nudity, at which point Emma would make an excuse and walk away, letting the others carry the thread to its natural conclusion, which was a discussion of sex. But tonight Emma was tired. She had just finished back-to-back flights. Los Angeles to Berlin with a big-name director and famous female movie star for a film premiere, after which the crew immediately refueled and flew back to Frankfurt to pick up the oil company executives. She had slept a few hours on the first leg, but now with the change in time zones and the knowledge that she needed to stay awake for at least 4 more hours, Emma found herself stifling a yawn.
"Oh, no," Chelsea said, catching her. "We are going out tonight. Fahad has it all lined up."
Fahad was Chelsea's London boy, a fashion designer who wore unlaced high tops with slim-fit suits. Emma liked him well enough, except the last time she was in London, he had tried to set her up with a Manchester ragamuffin artist who couldn't keep his hands to himself. Emma nodded and drank from her water bottle. At this time tomorrow, she would be on a charter to New York, then a quick trip to Martha's Vineyard, and home to Jane Street for a week-long vacation. In the city, she planned to sleep for 48 hours, then sit down and figure out what the hell she was doing with her life. Her mother was planning to come to the city for 3 nights, and Emma was excited to see her. It had been too long, and Emma felt the need for a giant mom hug and a hot pot of mac and cheese. She had planned to spend her last birthday in San Diego, but a charter had come up at double her normal rate, and she had taken it, spending her 25th birthday freezing her ass off in St. Petersburg. From now on, she thought, she would put her own needs first. Family. Love. She couldn't afford to end up one of these lifer widows with too much makeup and a boob job. She was old enough already. Time was running out. They pulled up in front of the corporate townhouse just after 7, the dusky London sky a rich midnight blue. Rain was forecast for tomorrow, but right now it was perfect summer weather.
"Looks like there's only one other crew tonight," Stanford said, pocketing their itinerary as they climbed from the car. "Chicago-based."
Emma felt a twinge of something. Worry? Dread? But it vanished almost as quickly when Chelsea gave her arm a squeeze.
"A quick bath and a vodka and we're off," she said.
Inside, they found Carver Ellis, the co-pilot for the Chicago flight, and 2 flight attendants dancing to French pop songs from the 1960s. Carver was a muscular black man in his 30s. He wore chinos and a white tank top and smiled when he saw her. Emma had flown with Carver a couple of times and liked him. He was lighthearted and always treated her professionally. Seeing him, Chelsea made a purring sound. She had a thing for black guys. The flight attendants were new to Emma, a blonde American and a pretty Spaniard. The Spaniard was in a towel.
"Now it's a party," Carver said as the Frankfurt crew rolled in.
Hugs and handshakes were exchanged. There was a bottle of Chopin vodka on the kitchen counter and a crate of fresh-squeezed orange juice. From the living room windows, you could see the treetops of Hyde Park. The song on the stereo was a drum and bass loop, sultry and infectious. Carver took Emma's hand, and she let herself be twirled. Chelsea kicked off her heels and jutted a hip, her hands lifted toward the ceiling. For a moment, they danced, letting the energy of the music and the thrum of their libidos rule them. The groove had a pocket you felt in your loins. How amazing to be young and alive in a modern European city. Emma took the first shower, standing under scalding water with her eyes closed. As always, there was that feeling in her bones that she was still moving, still hurtling through space at 400 miles per hour. Without realizing, she began to hum in the steamy glass stall. "People of the earth, can you hear me?" came a voice from the sky on that magical night. She towel-dried, her toiletry kit hanging from a hook by the sink. It was a testament to max efficiency, organized by region, hair, teeth, skin, nails. Standing naked, she brushed her hair with long, even strokes, then put on deodorant. She moisturized, first her feet, then her legs and arms. It was a way to ground herself, to remind herself she was real, not just an object hovering in midair. There was a quick knock at the door, and Chelsea slipped into the bathroom with glass tumbler in hand.
"Bitch," she said to Emma. "I hate that you're so thin."
She handed the glass to Emma and used both hands to squeeze the imaginary fat around her own middle. The glass was half full of vodka over ice with a floating slice of lime. Emma took one sip, then another. She felt the vodka moving through her, warming her from the inside. Chelsea pulled a glassine envelope from her skirt pocket and cut a line of coke on the marble countertop, working with professional efficiency.
"Ladies first," she said, handing Emma a rolled dollar bill.
Emma wasn't a huge fan of cocaine. She preferred pills, but if she was going to make it out the door tonight, she needed the pick-me-up. She bent and put the roll to her nose.
"Not all of it, you saucy cunt," said Chelsea,
slapping Emma's naked ass. Emma straightened, wiping at her nose. As always, there was a physical click in her head as the drug hit her bloodstream, the sensation of something in her brain being turned on. Chelsea racked the line and rubbed the remaining powder into her gums. She took Emma's brush and started in on her hair.
"It's going to get wild tonight," she said. "Trust me."
Emma wrapped herself in a towel, feeling every thread on her skin.
"I can't promise I'll stay out too late," she said. "Go home early and I'll smother you in your sleep," said Chelsea. "Or worse."
Emma zipped her toiletry kit. She knocked back what was left of the vodka. She pictured her father in a dirty white tee, frozen forever at 26. He walked toward her in slow motion. Behind him, a bigger man fell to the ground.
"Just try it, bitch," she told Chelsea. "I sleep with a blade."
Chelsea smiled.
"That's my girl," she said. "Now let's go out there and get proper fucked."
Coming out of the bathroom, Emma heard a man's voice. Later, she would remember the way her stomach lurched and time seemed to slow down.
"I took the knife away from him," said the man. "What did you think I'd do? Broke his arm in three places, too. Fucking Jamaica."
Panicking, Emma turned to duck back into the bathroom, but Chelsea was behind her. They knocked heads.
"Ow, shit!" said Chelsea loudly.
In the living room, everyone looked up. They saw Chelsea and Emma, in a white towel, doing a strange dance as Emma made one last attempt to disappear. And then Charlie Bush was on his feet, coming toward her, his arms wide.
"Hey, beautiful," he said. "Surprise!"
Cornered, Emma turned. The coke had turned on her, making the world jittery and uneven.
"Charlie! Charlie!" she said, trying to sound upbeat.
He gave her a kiss on both cheeks, his hands holding her by the shoulders.
"Put on a few, huh?" he said. "Too many desserts."
Her stomach lurched. He grinned.
"Just kidding," he said. "You look fantastic. Doesn't she look great?"
"She's in a towel," said Carver, sensing Emma's discomfort.
"Of course she looks great." "What do you say, babe?" said Charlie. "Want to run on in and put on something sexy? I hear we got big plans tonight. Big plans."
Emma forced a smile and stumbled to her room. The vodka made her legs feel like they were made out of paper. She closed the door and put her back to it, standing for a long moment with her heart pounding in her chest.
"Fuck," she thought. "Fuck, fuck, fuck."
It was 6 months since she'd last seen Charlie. 6 months of phone calls and texts. He was like a bloodhound after a scent. Emma had changed her phone number, had blocked his emails and unfriended him on Facebook. She ignored the texts, ignored the gossip from co-workers, how he was talking trash about her behind her back, how he called other girls by her name in bed. Her friends had told her to file a complaint with the company, but Emma was afraid. Charlie was somebody's nephew, she seemed to remember. Besides, she knew it was the squeaky wheel that got let go.
She had done so well, she thought.
She had made rules and stuck by them. She was the girl with her head on straight. Charlie
was her one mistake. It wasn't his fault, really. He couldn't help who found him attractive. He was tall and handsome with a rogue's scruff, a charmer with green eyes that had reminded Emma of her father, which, of course, was what it was.